UBC, which usually featured some kind of box being lowered into a black hole or some kind of a particle detector being accelerated. These really beautiful and elegant Gedanken experiments really appealed to me, and I think they're what made me decide to do my PhD with Bill and put me on the path to the kind of research that I've been interested in. The notion that particles are what make particle detectors click, that's how you can define and find out whether you have a particle. These sorts of very physical approaches to understanding the laws of physics. So when we worked on my PhD, understanding how to measure time by constructing a physical clock and seeing how long it took for the clock to how many clicks ticks and tocks the clock went through. So I picked a topic, quantum thermodynamics, which I think the approach we've taken is very much in the spirit of Bill's philosophy of doing physics, where you construct a physical, you look at a physical, you ask very physical questions. So for example, if you're trying to cool something, you can ask, you know, if I construct an actual device, a thermal machine, how long will it take to cool my system of interest? That's very similar to computer science, where you construct a Turing machine and then ask how long this Turing machine takes to perform a computation. Other questions in thermodynamics which take this approach is, if you want to understand the notion of work and heat, well, you need to consider this as being a very physical process. So the work is the raising and lowering of a weight, and it's by considering this very physical process as you shrink to the quantum regime, by thinking of these very physical processes, that I think you can make progress in thermodynamics. Right? And I think thermodynamics itself is really, if you want to define it, it's you know, what can an experimenter do? What are the ultimate limits of what an experimenter can do in trying to make a system go from one state to another? So I'll be presenting some joint work with on the third law of thermodynamics with Luis Massanis, and some work on the second law with Michał Hordecki, and work on second laws and zeroth laws with Fernando Brandão and others, Stephanie Wenner and Nelly Ng. So I think there's been, we're kind of entering, or not entering, but in the middle of a third wave of research into thermodynamics. The first wave you can think of as being very much kind of inspired by the problems of the day, how to build an efficient heat engine, very kind of physical processes, like you had people like Joule trying to, you know, actually sitting there with big devices, trying to convert work into heat and actually discovering that experimentally rather than theoretically. After that, you had this kind of second wave of thermodynamics where people understood the laws of thermodynamics as being statistical in nature. People like Maxwell, Boltzmann, and Gibbs. And I think we're now entering a third wave where we think of thermodynamics as being an information theory and about information. And that, of course, is not so new. I think it starts with Maxwell, where you have a Maxwell daemon who's trying to extract work and using the Maxwell, and the daemon uses their information in order to extract work. You had people like Landauer, Zillard, and Charlie Bennett who understood Maxwell's daemon in terms of information. And I think that's what's kind of started us on our trajectory to understanding thermodynamics as a kind of information theory. So just to kind of give a rough outline of what I'll be speaking about, I want to recast the laws of thermodynamics in a way that makes it applicable to quantum systems. And what we're going to find is that in ordinary thermodynamics, in the thermodynamics of large systems, you can think of a state transformation as being governed by one quantity, the free energy. And that, in some sense, is the fact that the free energy goes down is like the second law of thermodynamics. And what we're going to find is that there are many different free energies at the quantum level, or even at the microscopic level. And not only are there many second laws, but there's many families of second laws. And the, which family you're in is going to depend on how cyclic your process is. And then if we think of the second laws as telling us what states we're allowed to go to, the second law places a restriction on what states you can go to, then the time it takes you, how long it takes you to go from one state to another is like a third law. So we're used to the ordinary third law, which says that it takes an infinite time to cool a system to absolute zero. One can think of a generalized third law, which just says how long does it take you to go from one state to another. And I'll also talk about the zeroth and first law and argue that they're a bit to help define what thermodynamics is. And the mathematical tools we use are tools that were developed in the field of quantum information theory. So it's very much in the spirit of finding tools from computer science, from information theory, which we then can apply to the physical world. And I just put this up so that just people are aware there's a huge, and especially recently in the last couple of years, a huge explosion of research in this field. And I think it's a very interesting time to be in it at the moment. So classical thermodynamics or macroscopic thermodynamics, it's called thermodynamics because we take the thermodynamic limits. So we're always going to the situation where we have, we take the limit where we take an infinite number of particles or the system size becomes very large. And in such, when we take such a large system, the fluctuations, relatively speaking, become very small. And so the question is, can we have a thermodynamics in the opposite regime, when we have a finite size systems or the microscopic or nanoscale, and or when the system is quantum? And I think there was, for quite a while, people believed that you actually couldn't have a theory of thermodynamics in such a regime, that thermodynamics is a statistical theory where you need to look at very large systems. And considering finite size systems, you won't really get anything interesting. So in quantum thermodynamics, we don't take the thermodynamic limit. We imagine finite size systems. A friend of mine proposed that we should call this unlimited thermodynamics. And you may or may not have coherences in the energy eigenbasis. So this is another hallmark of quantum thermodynamics. Other hallmarks are that you can control often energy levels. So in the macroscopic case, we don't imagine that we know precisely where the particles are in the heat bath and we can control them. But here, we are allowed more precise control, or we may have more precise control of different states and levels. It's actually a remarkable thing is going to happen. You can imagine that you have more precise control, but in fact, you don't need it. We'll see that allowing more precise control doesn't allow us to violate the second law of thermodynamics, which for a while was what many people thought. On the other hand, you can achieve everything that the second law of thermodynamics allows without precise control. And what we'll see is that we can start to develop a rigorous theory. We're not all the way there yet. There's still a lot of unanswered questions, but we're starting to get a more rigorous theory of what the laws of quantum thermodynamics are. So just to remind people what the three laws of thermodynamics are, it's called the three laws of thermodynamics because there's four of them. The zeroth one is often, it's often claimed that this is what defines the temperature. So if I have a heat bath, a reservoir, which is reservoir number one is in equilibrium with reservoir number two, and reservoir two is in equilibrium with reservoir three, then reservoir one will also be in equilibrium with reservoir three. So it allows us to define an equivalence class of thermal states, of reservoirs. And they're the ones that have the same temperature, effectively. There's the first law of thermodynamics, which maybe it's not really even a law of thermodynamics, because in some sense it's just energy conservation. It's actually a law of physics, more than a law of thermodynamics. And then you have the Clausius statement, for example, of the second law. You have many other statements of the second law, which is just that heat can never pass from a colder body to a warmer body. So if I sit a cup of coffee in a room, it's not going to spontaneously cool down in this case. And then you have the third law, initially due to Nernst, and there's many statements of it. And the one I'm most interested in is the fact that one can never attain absolute zero in a finite number of steps. And so what we want to do is we want to see, do these four laws apply to quantum systems? How do they apply to quantum systems? And what we'll find is we need to reformulate them and that they do change, but they also are, you know, are nonetheless hold true. So as I mentioned, the first law, which is just energy conservation, it was originally postulated due to experiment, and we now know that it's just a law of physics, and I wouldn't say it's a law of thermodynamics. So what it just says is that if I have a work system, some working body, some sort of piston system and a reservoir, then the total energy of all these systems is conserved. And if energy is not conserved, then you're probably just forgetting one of your systems. All right? So this is just a law of physics. So we can remove the first law in some sense. It's not really a law of thermodynamics. The second law, just that your cup of coffee will not heat up in the summer, at least. It will not heat up as long as you have a cyclic process. On the other hand, you can make a cup of coffee heat up on a hot day by putting work into your system. So you can think, in some sense, the second law quantitatively is about how much work is required to go from one state to another state. The second law, as originally formulated, or I think as formulated up until recently, is a law which applies to no physical process that we know of. Right? It's completely useless as it stands law, because what it says is that no heat can pass from a colder body to a warmer body without some other change occurring. And there's always some other change occurring. Now, if I have some environment, there's always a few molecules which, and I sit there with my piston and I try and make a hot cup of coffee heat up, there will always be some change occurring in the environment or in the reservoir. So the second law doesn't really apply to anything that we can do in the laboratory as it's currently stated. What you need to ask is, how cyclic is your process? And if you say I want it to be cyclic and I don't want to have any other change occurring, what you really mean is the change in the environment is small. And then the question becomes, how small is it? And do I still have laws of thermodynamics if I just demand that the process is approximately cyclic, or that the change in the environment is small rather than zero? Right? Is that clear so far, just this classical picture of the laws of thermodynamics? Going a bit slow, maybe. If we want to quantify the second law, I think the nicest way to do that, or at least the way I will be doing that, is to include the first law into the second law, because the first law is just a law of physics. And so what it really says is that in any cyclic process, the free energy has to go down. Right? In any cyclic process, the free energy has to go down. And the free energy not only just has to go down, but in some sense you can quantify the amount of work which is required in order to go from some initial state to some final state by the change in the free energy. So the free energy serves two purposes. One is that it tells you what state transformations are possible. You can only go from some initial state to some final state if the free energy goes down. But it also tells you how much work you're going to have to do if you want to do something in which the free energy is going up. Right? And it also tells you, if the free energy goes down, it tells you how much work you can extract in the process of going from one state to another state. Right? So I have some state out of equilibrium, going to another state out of equilibrium, and the change in free energy tells me how much work I can extract. So Now we want to see if these laws hold in the quantum regime or in the just the finite size regime. And the first thing, I think, when I started learning thermodynamics in high school or undergrad, I never really understood it. And part of the reason it was difficult to understand is I never knew what thermodynamics was. You're never really told what you're allowed to do. There was all these adiabats and isotherms and this and that, but there was no rigorous theory of what is thermodynamics? What are the rules? You know, with particle physics, we have a Lagrangian, we know what we're trying to do, but in thermodynamics, I think there was never, at least for me, there was never really a precise definition of what thermodynamics is. So the first thing we want to do is we want to say, what is thermodynamics? What are we allowed to do when we want to go from one state to another? And if we're interested in studying ultimate bounds, so we're going to give the experimenter as much power as possible. So we're going to allow them to do anything that the laws of physics allows in the context of what we think thermodynamics is. And so let's start. So we're going to call this, it's called catalytic thermal operations. We have some system that we're interested in. We're going to sometimes call that the resource or the system. That has a Hamiltonian, so that's what we're given as input, some system with some Hamiltonian. What we're going to be allowed to do is we're going to be allowed to add some free state. This is going to turn out to be the thermal state or the Gibbs state, but for the moment, I'm not going to tell you what it is. That's going to emerge. So we're just allowed to add some free state to help us manipulate this resource. We're going to have a work system. I'll say what that is. And we're allowed to use any equipment we want, right? And that is going to be, we're going to call that a catalyst, which is maybe a strange word to use, but we're going to call it a catalyst because we're interested often in cyclic processes. So a cyclic process is one where you start with some initial state and go to a final state, which is very close to what your initial state is. So that's a bit like a catalyst or an approximate catalyst. So we're allowed to borrow some lab equipment and return it back in the same state, where we'll have to say what same means. And then we're going to demand energy conservation because that's a law of nature. We can't get around that. And like I said, if you're violating energy conservation, it means you're just ignoring a system. So that is not a restriction, really, to demand energy conservation. And finally, we're allowed to throw stuff away. Is that clear what thermodynamics is now?
It's HC. It's a definition of the Hamiltonian.
This HS?
No,
HR. Oh, so that's the reservoir. So that's our heat bath. And we're going to allow any Hamiltonian on the heat bath. We don't often have control of what the Hamiltonian in the reservoir is. HC is the catalyst. So this is the Hamiltonian of our working body. We're allowed you can choose your lab equipment with any HC you want. So a system and a work system.
So you don't have any interaction Hamiltonian between them. So you just have free Hamiltonian for each?
It turns out you can have an interaction Hamiltonian, yeah. But we're going to, in this case, we're going to demand that initially and finally the system, initially at least we're going to imagine, so the only, in the theory of thermodynamics, you can have any interaction you want, but when we consider a state transformation, we're going to imagine that initially our system is not entangled or correlated with our reservoir, for example, or our equipment. So there's a system sitting here which is in a product state, and then we're going to come to it and manipulate it. So initially, there's no correlations. Finally, of course, you can have correlations, and you can have an interaction in Hamiltonian. Okay. So the first thing we have to define is what is work. Macroscopically, work you can think of as the raising of a weight. Macroscopically, you don't care that there's fluctuations in the weight. So you might raise it, and you raise it a meter, and of course it doesn't raise exactly a meter each time. There are small fluctuations. So here, we can ask, what does that correspond to in the quantum regime? I'm going to here consider it to be just the raising of what I would call a wit, a work bit. So initially it's in the ground state, and finally we raise it. You can consider a continuous system, like a weight, like a harmonic oscillator, where you might be able to raise it a different amount each time. So what I'm going to say is independent of the system you choose. But I'm often interested in deterministically raising, just like a weight, raising it up some level, I want to raise. the energy level of some system, quantum system. All right. So that's my definition of work. It's not a, it's a process raising an energy level. So you can think of it like extracting pure energy in its purest form. Right? And there's been quite a lot written about the equivalence or the inequivalence of various definitions. So here are a recasting of the three of the laws of thermodynamics. I'm going to save the third law for a bit later. First, we have the class of operations. We define what quantum thermodynamics is. And what we find, so energy conserving unitaries is the definition of what we allow for the class of operations of thermodynamics. And we're going to find what emerges is the zeroth law. We're going to find that the only free state we're allowed is the thermal state, is the Gibbs state. If we were to allow any other state as our free resource, the theory would become trivial and you would be allowed to do anything. So the zeroth law emerges as giving you, it helps define, so the zeroth law emerges and defines the temperature by giving you an equivalence class of states which you're allowed to use as an experimenter such that your theory is non-trivial. Any other state, you would be able to do anything you wanted. Yeah?
Sorry, this is the state of the reservoir, the initial state of the reservoir.
Well, so when I defined thermodynamics, I said, you know, one of my class of operations was you're allowed to use some free states, which we call the reservoir. But I didn't say what that is.
And free here means what?
Free here means you're allowed as many of them as you want. You're allowed any Hamiltonian you want. Or it could be fixed. The Hamiltonian could also be fixed, but you're essentially allowed to use as much of them as you want in order to make your transformation go.
And your second question I had was, you say if you have any other state than the Gibbs state, you can do whatever you want.
That's right.
If you have the totally mixed state?
Sorry?
If you have the totally mixed state.
Totally mixed state with that, and the Hamiltonian is not trivial.
Okay, so then you
then I can, then basically what I can do is I can take a weight. And I'll show you in a moment. Okay. And then, so I'll get to that in a second. And then what we're going to find is that the second law, there's two versions of that, one for closed systems, or sorry, not closed systems, but one for single systems, which are in contact with this heat bath, and one for cyclic processes with working bodies. And what we're going to find is that there's many of them. There's not just one second law, there's many of them. And they're represented by a family of free energies, F alpha. And effectively, what happens is that our initial state, it gets closer and closer to the thermal state in terms of some quantities, which are these F alphas, these free and generalized free energies. And that is the new kind of class, the set of second laws, which we find for finite size systems. Okay. For single systems, we've been calling this thermomajorization. For those who maybe have a bit of a quantum information background or just a mathematical background, they might have heard majorization. This is a kind of a version of that we call thermomajorization. And what we're going to find is that these free energies are going to depend on how cyclic our process is. So to get to Raymond's question, why do we have the zeroth law? Well, take the maximum mixed state. What you can do is, if the probabilities are not thermal, what you can always, so there's something called a passive state. A passive state has the probability I is smaller than the probability J, if and only if the energy of I is greater than the energy of J. If that's not the case, if you have a probability of having a state with a higher energy level, then you can always extract work just by saying, I'm going to lower the energy level of my system and raise the energy level of my weight. And in order to have it self-adjoint, on the other hand, if it's in the lower energy state, I'm going to raise the level of the system and lower the energy of the weight. And if the probabilities are not ordered by that, then if you keep doing this process on many copies of this reservoir, then you will gradually raise your weight. All right? So by this process, you can effectively extract work from your free state, as much as you want unless your free state satisfies this. And it turns out the only thing which satisfies this when you have many copies is the thermal state. That's due to a result of Voronovich. Right? So only the thermal state. The thermal state is the only state you're allowed in thermodynamics. Otherwise, your theory becomes trivial and you can extract arbitrary amount of work from your heat bath. So that's the zeroth law, defines the notion of temperature. The second law are these monotones. I've just written them here. Monotones meaning they must go down under this class of catalytic thermal operations. So what happens is you have something called a relative entropy distance. Turns out that this thing keeps getting closer, it's contractive, keeps getting closer to the thermal state under any thermal operations. And there's many of them, there's a whole family of them. And so instead of just one, you have many. And it turns out that if you take the thermodynamic limit, all these F alphas become closer and closer to the ordinary free energy. Right? So you have all these additional free energies, which for finite size systems are very different, and in the macroscopic limit become the same. So that's why we only have 1 second law, one free energy, is because when you take the thermodynamic limit, all these free energies are the same. But for microscopic systems, or actually even just strongly correlated systems, they're all different. And I should say, for states which are block diagonal on the energy eigenbasis, these second laws are if and only if. So not only does the second law tell us place a restriction, saying what we cannot go to, but they also tell us what we can go to. And anything that's allowed by these second laws, we can find a process which will do it. Yeah?
So maybe I just missed something. Where's the direction of time come into this? Because the ordinary second law has an arrow of time.
Right, so these are monotones. So the free energy is, the free energy is always going down. That's the ordinary second law. So the arrow of time is just saying it goes down and not up. And here, these are all going down as well.
But there's no time in there, so that's not.
Well, you're starting from some initial state. You're going to some final state. So there is an initial and a final. So in that sense, there is a time. And it's just saying, you can tell what's an initial. If I give you two states, I can order them in time by saying this one is closer to the Gibbs state, to the thermal state, and therefore it must have. It's a final state, not the initial state.
Rho and tau are the initial and final.
Sorry. Rho is the initial state. Rho is just some state. Tau is the Gibbs, the thermal state. This Gibbs, the free state that we're allowed. And so this is actually a distance between your state and the Gibbs state. And the second laws are just saying this quantity is always going down. And so you're always getting closer and closer to the Gibbs state.
So all of those quantities, no matter what alpha is, always go down.
That's right. I'll give some examples maybe so you can see them in a moment.
Even alpha of 10 to the 10 to the 3rd.
That corresponds to the largest eigenvalue, effectively. If you take alpha going to infinity,
right. That's
actually turns out to be one of the important ones, and that one corresponds to the largest. So, if I take the quantity p of some energy level times e to the beta e times the energy of that level. Then if I look for the largest one of these, that corresponds to alpha going to infinity.
And the smallest of tau?
The smallest will be alpha going to zero.
No, I mean, because you get 1/tau coming in there.
Yes.
So if alpha gets very large, it's going to pick out the smallest eigenvalue of tau.
Well, if alpha gets very large, it's going this. So this. So that's why you have this quantity here. Effectively. So you're picking up, the largest. I mean, this is picking out this once. This favors the largest probability, and this favors the largest e to the beta e.
Right.
And so you're picking up the largest combination of those two things, product of those two things.
What's the difference between going to the microscopic unit and taking H bar to zero? Or the
Think of it like compression. So in some sense, the law of large numbers, when you do Schumacher compression, tells you that the only thing that matters is the, you know, roughly the size of the
beast. It's the same dependent of H bar.
And it has nothing to do with H bar, exactly.
So it's the same.
Yeah.
When you say blob-blob diagonal, you're saying blob diagonal?
In the energy eigenbasis.
Including interactions, if you have any.
Well, here, this is the, yeah, so here is just the Hamiltonian of the system.
Right.
So we're, yeah.
And you said alpha goes between 0 and infinity?
Alpha can go between 0 and infinity.
And so what happened at alpha equal to 1?
Alpha going to 1, this is just the ordinary free energy. You take the limit. So they all correspond. So in the in the macroscopic limit, all the F alphas go to F1. So that's just, that's it. There's a bunch of quantum second laws we found. They're not necessary and sufficient. We don't know about sufficiency. And they're related to a bunch of these alphas turn out to be related to something called various quantum Reni divergences, which have been discovered by various people. We know that some of them are monotones, but we don't have a complete characterization for states which are not block diagonal. I think that's one of the big open questions in this field is, what do you do when you don't have a block diagonal state, which has coherences in the energy levels? We have these limitations. So they're like second laws. They tell us what we cannot do, but they don't tell us, you know, they're not if and only if. So we've kind of discussed this a bit. The F going to infinity is just the largest e to the beta h, and F zero, H is whether a level is occupied or not. If it's 1, if it's occupied, 0 otherwise. And it turns out that these two, the F infinity and the F zero, are very special. They correspond to how much work is required to start. So F infinity corresponds to the work required to form a state. For those who know entanglement theory, it's like the entanglement cost or the entanglement of formation. So you start with the thermal state. You try and create some other state rho, and the amount of work that's going to be required is given by F infinity. On the other hand, if you want to do the opposite process, we want to start with some state and distill work, then it's given by F zero, which is the, you know, Gibbs factored weights rank in some sense. So you have two extreme cases, this F zero and the F infinity. In entanglement theory, they're a bit like the entanglement of distillation and the entanglement of formation. And they tell you how much work is required to form a state, how much work is required, how much work you can get from a state. In the thermodynamic limit, they're all just equal to the ordinary free energy. And there you have reversibility, but here you don't have reversibility. So that's one of the things we find at the quantum level. We don't have reversibility like we do in the macroscopic case. So I mentioned some examples. You want some examples? So let's take the case of a trivial Hamiltonian, H equals zero. The largest eigenvalue, the largest probability of an energy level, of any level, I guess I've said H equals zero and I've got E here, but just the largest of any level, can't get any larger. So you can imagine, you know, you can imagine cases where you have a density matrix and the entropy increases, but the largest eigenvalue gets larger. And the ordinary second law that you're used to would tell you that that's an allowed transition. But what we're saying is it's not allowed transition. So there's additional laws that were not known before which govern whether you can go from one state to another. Right? Likewise, the rank of the density matrix, you could imagine that the entropy increases, so you're respecting the ordinary second law, but the rank can get smaller and the entropy can still increase, the rank of your density matrix. Well, that's not allowed either. So we have an additional second law which rules that out. Right? So you have all these additional constraints. I mean, this is not a very physical one, but you can make it more physical by actually ignoring all the occupied levels which have some very tiny probability. So you can make this more physical. But you, so you have all these additional constraints which tell you whether you can go from one state to another. And in the case where h equals zero, these laws are just something called majorization, which just tells you that the sum of the largest k probabilities or eigenvalues can't get any larger.
Is there a way to take the classical limit of this?
That's right, yeah. So in the classical limit, so say you have many, say in a non-interacting gas, you have many copies of your state, then those of you who know about law of large numbers or compression, Schumacher compression or Shannon compression, will recognize that majorization just corresponds to just the ordinary law of entropy increase. And that's what, because what happens is all your small all the eigenvalues become roughly equal in the thermodynamic limit. So everything becomes equiprobable in the thermodynamic limit in some sense. So if all your probabilities are equal, then the rank is equal to the largest eigenvalue, or the, at least the approximate rank is equal to the largest eigenvalue is equal to e to the entropy, or 2 to the entropy if you're bits. For diagonal states or block diagonal states, these second laws say that the largest probability times e to the beta e can't get any larger, and your Gibbs weighted rank, so this is just saying whether a level is occupied or not, that can't get any larger either. Oh, sorry, that can't get any smaller. That's a mistake there. This works quite a nice in terms of diagrams. So people are familiar with majorization as a diagram. You have a curve, and you can only go from red to blue if your curve is above the blue curve, if the red curve is above the blue curve. Likewise, we can draw these nice diagrams. We call them thermomajorization curves, and we can only go from one state to another if the curve of one is above the curve of another. So there's a very nice kind of diagrammatic calculus you can do here. In addition, these laws tell you how much work you can extract in a deterministic way. And you can make this a bit more physical by relaxing what you mean by deterministic a bit. But for now, let's talk about strict determinism. Let's say I want to extract work from my knowledge that a molecule is on the left-hand side of a box. Well, you're probably all familiar with how you do that. You put in a piston, like a Maxwell demon. You put a piston, well, you know a Maxwell demon because you know, it's already known that the molecule is on the left-hand side. You put a piston in and you let the molecule push out the piston, and that allows you to extract kT bits of work from your knowledge of the fact that the molecule was on the left-hand side, in the left-hand partitions. That's just a Zillard engine. And so the amount of the distillable work in this case is just kT.
What's the T in that?
Oh, sorry, here you imagine that this is in a thermal reservoir, and so it's giving you, it's what's providing the kinetic energy of this molecule bouncing around. On the other hand, if the probability of being on the left-hand side was just 2/3, the probability of being on the right-hand side was 1/3, so you don't have exact information about where the molecule is, then the amount of work you can extract with certainty is zero, right? Because if you put the piston here on the right-hand side, then you'll extract work with probably 2/3, but if you want to do it deterministically and always succeed, then with probably 1/3, you'll fail, and the molecule will push your piston in the wrong direction. So you really need that you know exactly where the molecule is in order to extract work deterministically. And that's why you get this rank of the density matrix appears as one of your second laws, because the amount of work you can extract deterministically is going to depend on having unoccupied levels, or in this case, unoccupied Bach partitions, and you can extract a work given by the difference in the rank of the log of the rank of the initial state and the final state. Work of formation, in the case of a degenerate Hamiltonian, we start with a maximally mixed state. There's, so here's this is the Gibbs state initially. We don't know, we have no idea on what side of the partition the molecule is in. Let's say we want to create the state of two-thirds, one-third. That was the one we could not extract any work from whatsoever. So the work of distillation was zero. And we can do it by pushing in the molecule a little bit and then sticking in the partition. And now it's going to have probably two-thirds of being on the left-hand side and probably one-third of being on the right-hand side. So it requires a bit of work. And you can see here that the amount of work that's required is going to be really related to the largest probability, because if the probability, if you want to form a state which is probably one of being in the left partition, you're going to have to push this piston in a lot in order to make sure that there's zero probability of being on the right side. And so the larger the probability is that you're trying to create, the more you have to push in the molecule. Okay. Good. Let me now say, our second laws are how saying that the free energy always has to go down in any cyclic process. And the question is, how cyclic should this process be? And if we're in the macroscopic limits, we just say, well, approximately cyclic. So you give me some epsilon that's very small, and I just demand that the environment is within some, say, fidelity, is within some epsilon of the initial state. That you would think would be good enough, right? Anyone think that's good enough? Okay, one person. I guess I'm asking the question, so you can probably imagine that it's not going to be good enough. So it turns out that if you give me any epsilon, no matter how small it is, so you say, I want my cyclic process to be epsilon cyclic, where epsilon is, you know, 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2 in fidelity from its original state. Turns out that no matter how small epsilon is, modulo some Planck nonsense, no matter how small epsilon is, I can always find for you a process which will violate the second law. Right? So there is no, you tell me any epsilon that you want the environment to be, you want an epsilon close to its initial state at the end of the cyclic process, I will always be able to find a process which violates the second law in terms of that notion of cyclicity. Right? So approximately cyclic with some fixed epsilon does not work. It's related to something in entanglement theory called embezzlement. There exist states that you can embezzle entanglement from. And it turns out that there's such a thing as work embezzlement, where I give you some working body which barely changes, yet the amount of work you can extract from that working body is arbitrarily large. You have to make the environment larger and larger in order to do this, but you can always do that. Right? So if this is our environment or our catalyst or our working body, we look at the initial state versus the final state. And if we just say that it should be epsilon in trace distance close, then all transformations are possible and there are no second laws. If, on the other hand, we demand that in closeness, it's a scale like some epsilon over log d, where d is the dimension of the working body or the catalyst, then we just recover the ordinary second law, F1. And if we demand that, there's various measures you can use, but if we look at something smaller than this for various measures, then we find we get all this whole array of second laws. And a lot of the current work, if people are interested in this field, a lot of the current work is in better understanding these second laws. So for example, understanding this notion of how do we get these different families? Are there only these three families? So there's a whole understanding the notion of catalysis. That's kind of an interesting open problem. Understanding these second laws in the case where you don't have block diagonal states and you have coherences, and also something nice about, you know, probabilistic transformations, which is something you can have a probabilistic transformation in the quantum or microscopic case, but this is not something you can have in the thermodynamic limit. Right? So these are kind of some current topics of interest. I want to just, in the final time allowed, just mention briefly the third law. So initially, Nernst and others formulated something called the heat theorem, which said that that was the original version of the third law. It says when the temperature approaches absolute zero, the entropy of the substance approaches zero. We know that's not strictly true. I mean, this is just saying the ground state is not degenerate, but we know that we can have systems which have a degenerate ground state. So then a modified version of the heat theorem would say, well, when you approach absolute zero, which is just approaching the ground state, the entropy approaches some constant. Well, that's just saying that if I have a system, the ground state has a certain degeneracy, G. So that's not an interesting theorem, I think, in the modern understanding. It's not even a law of thermodynamics. So we can, I think, safely ignore this one. Nernst also formulated the unattainability principle, originally to try and bolster the heat theorem. But we now know, I think, that it has nothing to do with the heat theorem. But what he said was that if you want to approach absolute zero, it's going to require an infinite number of steps or an infinite time. And there was a lot of argument back and forth on whether this principle was true. And I think until now, there's been no proof of it. And what's more, it's not a quantitative statement. So of course, you can never attain exactly absolute zero. So what you're really interested in is how close can I get to absolute zero given a certain amount of time. So what we want to do is A, prove the unattainability principle, and B, quantify it, because to make it meaningful, we need to say, given a certain amount of time, how close can we get to absolute zero? And what we found is that if we have an initial temperature T and a final temperature T prime, and you can also formulate this for things that are not completely thermal, then roughly speaking, the temperature you can reach scales to some inverse power of the time. And we do that by constructing something called a thermal machine, which is a bit like, a bit inspired by computer science. So in computer science, you have the Church-Turing thesis, which just says, you know, every computer is roughly equivalent to any other computer, at least in classical case, if you look at the modified Church-Turing thesis. And you know, a Turing machine has a certain finite speed at which it writes to its memory. It interacts with memory by moving from one to another, and it does this at a finite speed. So the Church-Turing thesis basically just says, well, we fix some computer which has a finite speed of moving from memory site to memory site. It has a finite time for writing onto the memory. And once we've fixed our Turing machine, then we can quantify how long it takes to solve a problem. We want to adopt the same approach here. We have a thermal machine. We fix its time of moving from memory site to memory site, which in this case is like the volume of the heat bath. D is the dimension. D is some constant. We want to say that it's, in a finite time, it can't inject an infinite amount of work into the system and reservoir. And that, of course, I think this is not really controversial, that in a finite time, it can only interact with a finite volume and only inject a finite amount of work. And under this notion of a thermal machine, we get a third law. I should say the precise law you get is determined. It depends on the density of states of your heat bath, and you get a violation if you get if you have an exponentially growing density of states for a finite volume. But these things are that's an unphysical system because you don't have a temperature for such a system, and it violates the Bekenstein bound, which you may or may not be bothered about. But we don't know of any systems which have an exponential density of states for finite size. And the method of proving the third law is just unitarity, and it just involves mapping some initial states to final states. We just say, if you want a unitary process, we'll take a bunch of initial states of the system and bath and map them to a smaller set of final states. Right? So here's the example of an erasure of a bit. So we have a bit which is either in the 0 or 1 state. So this is initially, it's in the 0 or 1 state here. So it's either in this panel or this panel. We want to map it to a final state, which is in the ground, in the zero state, so it's always going to be mapped to the zero state. And now we ask, can we do it? Are there enough states which will allow us to do that? So for example, if initially we look at some energy window between zero and E0, all the green, that's, so these are the states of the, each dot here represents a state of the reservoir. Initially we have some state of the reservoir represented by a green dot or a blue dot, depending on whether the system is in the zero or one state. We want to finally map it to states of the system reservoir in which the system is only in the zero state. So you need to map these two panels to this one panel. And that's why you have a third law, because it's, that's why it's difficult. You have to map all the states in these bottom two panels to just this one panel. Time, okay. All right, I'll just finish up with this. And so in order to do that, we need to inject work into our system in order to find unoccupied levels. And it turns out that if you want to do it with certainty, you need to add in an infinite amount of work in order to find enough holes, in some sense, free states in your reservoir at which to do it. Okay, good. So just to conclude, we've reformulated the laws of thermodynamics in such a way that the first law just helps us define our class of operations. The zeroth law emerges as defining the temperature and tells us what our free states are. The second law tells us what transformations are possible. A generalized third law tells us how long it takes to go to those states. And there's, I think, many, so even though we now have these kind of basic laws, there's just many other questions we have, like understanding the role of coherences, getting, I think, better quantitative third laws, understanding probabilistic transformations and the like. So I think there's a lot of interesting problems in this field. And with that, I'll thank you for your attention.
Much based on the discreteness of the system, I wonder what happens if you go to a field. I mean, no longer need to generalize now the notion of the zero machine without having position, probabilities are going to be probability densities, so that it can be negative. You might have many things. I'm wondering if you can understand the continuous field phase.
Yeah, that's not something that, I don't think anyone's actually done that for these sorts of things. We're looking at the discrete case here. But I think you have some tools to do it, because what you're talking about here, we've reformulated the laws in terms of a relative entropy distance. So in the case of a continuum, the entropy is infinite in some sense. So it's difficult to talk about that. On the other hand, how close something is to the Gibbs state is something that can be finite. Because you still have a well-defined Gibbs state in the continuum. And so you have a relative entropy distance, which can tell in how far away you are in terms of relative entropy distance, is something that you can maybe talk about in the continuum. So I suspect that it is not too, that you will be able to do that in the continuum, although no one has done that.
I'm thinking confused about the H-bar, the notion of H-bar. If H-bar goes to zero, then
Yeah, I mean, in this case, you know, we just have a discrete system, and in some sense, H bar does. You can have discrete classical systems as well by considering, say, just blocks. So, in that sense, that's not a question we address in this.
Have you thought about anything like a statistical mechanical derivation of this version of the laws of thermodynamics?
I mean, this is, in some sense, so if by statistical mechanics you mean averages, I want to talk about, you know, average quantities, then you can do that. And that's an interesting question, especially when it comes to coherences. So you can ask, for example, you know, here, the amount of work you might be able to extract will fluctuate a little bit each time. So if you want to go from some state rho, take the case where you want to go from some state rho to some state sigma, the free energy difference might be zero. That doesn't tell you can go from rho to sigma, because you might sometimes have to put in work and sometimes you'll get work. So you can only go from rho to sigma if you now have a way of inputting and gaining work. And now you can go from this to averages, and then you find that the work you extract, although it's, you can, so this allows you to say how much work you could, the probability distribution of work in some sense, although that can be a dangerous term, the probability distribution of work each time, you can find that on average it'll be zero. And so in some sense, statistical mechanics emerges as being about averages. How much work will be required on average to go from?
I was thinking more about fluctuations out of equilibrium. So you have a system in sort of maximum entropy state, and in ordinary thermodynamics.
Right. So this tells you exactly that how much.
Okay.
How the fluctuations are. They actually are related. The probability of a fluctuation in this case is related to how much work is required to go from one to the other, and vice versa. Okay. So I didn't put it up, but with two students of mine, we looked at kind of, you know, what the probability is. Say it requires work to go from rho to sigma. In the thermodynamic limit, if you ask what the probability of going from rho to sigma, if I don't have any work, you can't do it. It'll be zero. But for finite state systems, you can compute the probability of going from one state to another probabilistically without adding work. And that turns out, as I mentioned, to be sandwiched between the work of formation in both, of transition in both directions.
Another question? Trillin, I have a question. So could you experimentally verify that if you think of setting up an experiment and show that certain forces are not allowed or allowed?
Yeah, you can. I mean, so I think, so the ones to test might be things like this. Okay. And you need a way of, I guess, measuring the energies without disturbing the evolution.
But if you look at current experimental, or what is like, some fields like you can drop single atoms.
Right.
Have you ever thought about how this would be possible?
Yes, I've been in discussion with some groups about trying to verify this.
And it is possible currently in principle?
Yeah, I think it's possible. Yeah. One just has to do the experiment.
So let's thank Jonathan again.